Richard Martin's Wake Up Call podcast, presented every Monday and Friday, providing you with the truth and the facts. You decide.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, whatever your time zone, whatever hour of the day you are listening, welcome to the Wake Up Call. This is Richard Martin, and it is a very hot and sultry morning here as I compose this edition for your enjoyment. It is Monday, November the 30th, 2015. Thanksgiving is now over, and so now we have to concentrate on Christmas and ingratiating ourselves with loved ones and others by bribing them to love us. Buying them tokens of our undying love and appreciation for their existence on planet Earth. How divine! What a wonderful race is the human variety. We are such generous souls, are we not? To think that we could sacrifice ourselves in this way to make other people happy? Well, let's look at this in a little more detail, shall we? Has there ever been a major holiday more focused on materialism than the modern American Christmas? This year, Americans are planning to spend an average of $830 on Christmas gifts, which represents a jump of $110 over the average of $720 last year. But have incomes gone up accordingly? Of course not. In fact, real median household income in the United States has been experiencing a steady long-term decline. So in order to fund all the Christmas spending, Americans have got to go into even more debt. Oh, they'll claim they're paying cash, but they're lying. They love to pull out their credit cards and spend money that they don't have on lots of cheap, useless stuff made on the other side of the world by workers making slave labor wages. America does the same thing year after year, and most people have grown accustomed to the endless cycle of growing debt. In fact, one Pew survey found that approximately 70% of all Americans believe that, quote-unquote, debt is a necessity in their lives. But then you have to work your fingers to the bone to try to make the payments on all of that debt, not realizing that debt systematically impoverishes you. It may be hard to believe, but if you have a single dollar in your pocket and no debt, you have a greater net worth than 25% of all Americans. Overall, when you add up all forms of debt, consumer, business, local government, state government, and federal government, Americans are more than $60 trillion in debt. Let that sink in for a moment. 40 years ago, that number was about $3 trillion. America has been on the greatest debt binge in the history of the world. Even though its people were, quote-unquote, the wealthiest, most prosperous nation on the entire planet, they always had to have more. They just kept on borrowing and borrowing and borrowing from the future until they completely destroyed it. And they still haven't learnt anything. Instead, this Christmas season, America will be partying like it's 2007. Yes, it's true. Americans are planning to celebrate Christmas like 2007. A November survey by Gallup found that U.S. adults are planning to spend about $830 on average on Christmas gifts this year. That's a huge jump from last year's $720 average. Notably, American consumers haven't suggested a number that high since November 2007, when they were planning on spending $866 on average. Unfortunately, incomes simply do not justify this kind of extravagance. As Zero Hedge has pointed out, household incomes, quote-unquote, actually peaked at least 15 years ago in 81% of US counties. So why can't people adjust their lifestyles to match? Why must people always have more? Here are more details on America's declining incomes from the Visual Capitalist. Income peaked 1 year ago for many of the counties that are part of the shale boom. This includes much of North and South Dakota, as well as parts of Texas, Nebraska, and Oklahoma. Income in Washington, D.C. and neighboring Arlington County also peaked then. In 1999, a total of 1,623 counties had their households reach peak income. The majority of these counties are in the Midwest, and states along the Rocky Mountains, such as Wyoming and Montana, had counties that peaked roughly 35 years ago. Household income peaked in upstate New York, the northern tip of California, and southern Nevada at the same time that humans were first landing on the moon in 1969. But you won't hear any of this reported on mainstream media news now, will you? They want us to think that happy days are here again. Real median household income in the United States has been trending down since 1999. Americans should be having smaller Christmases instead of bigger ones, but that doesn't fit the image of who they still think they are. As I've mentioned so often here on the Wake Up Call, the quality of American jobs is not great. 38% of all American workers made less than $20,000 last year. 51% of all American workers made less than $30,000 last year. And 62% made less than $40,000 last year. 71% made less than $50,000 last year. Without a doubt, most Americans should not be spending hundreds of dollars a year on Christmas gifts. At these income levels, most American families are just barely surviving. But once again this year, millions upon millions of Americans will flock to the malls and big box stores in a desperate attempt to make themselves happy. Sadly, those efforts will be in vain. In fact, just the other day here, I highlighted the fact that Christmas is the unhappiest season of the year. The suicide rate spikes to the highest level of the year during the holidays, and 45% of all Americans report that they dread the Christmas season. The following is an excerpt from a Psychology Today article, and I quote, "We are told that Christmas, for Christians, should be the happiest time of year, an opportunity to be joyful and grateful with family, friends, and colleagues. Yet, according to the National Institute of Health, Christmas is the time of year that people experience the highest incidence of depression in. Hospitals and police forces report the highest incidences of suicide and attempted suicide. Psychiatrists, psychologists, and other mental health professionals report a significant increase in patients complaining about depression." End of quote. One North American survey reported that 45% of respondents dreaded the festive season. In recent years, an increasing number of Americans have given up the tradition of Christmas gifts entirely, and many of them seem quite happy to have done so. Of course, most people are still quite satisfied with the status quo, and there are many who will get very angry with you if you dare to suggest that the way that Americans celebrate Christmas has gotten way out of hand. But shouldn't it alarm us that for most Americans, the biggest holiday of the year is all about the stuff they are going to buy, the stuff they are going to give, and the stuff they are going to get? As a society, we are obsessed with things, but those things are never going to make us happy. Perhaps we should all take some time to reflect on the traditions that we choose to participate in and what they really mean to us during this holiday season. Well, despite the bogus BLS employment report last week, so the Fed could raise rates before the next financial crisis hits, all economic data confirms an economic recession. Corporate profits are falling, and their forecasts for next quarter are worse. Global trade is slowing dramatically. Oil prices and other commodities are plummeting to multi-year lows. Manufacturing and services surveys are flashing red. China, Japan, and European economies continue to suck wind. Layoff announcements by major corporations are up 40% over last year. A global deflationary recession is underway. Only a CNBC bimbo, shill, or Ivy League educated economist isn't bright enough to see it. Retail sales came out last week, and they were worse than dreadful. They confirmed the horrific quarterly reports from Macy's, Nordstrom's, and Kohl's. Total retail sales grew a minuscule 0.1% from September, and only 1.7% versus last year. It's even worse than it looks. When you back out the subprime auto loan spurred auto sales, really long-term rentals, retail sales grew only 0.5% over last year. That is far less than true inflation. So on a real basis, retail sales are falling like a rock. This only happens during recessions. And it isn't a one-month thing. Retail sales, even including loan-boosted auto sales, are flat over the last 3 months and up only 2.1% for the first 10 months of the year. The decline in gasoline sales due to plunging prices has contributed to the lousy retail sales numbers, but the storyline of the economic bulls was how this was going to boost the spending of consumers across the board. That storyline is as dead as an Obamacare patient. It seems all the gasoline savings immediately went to pay for the soaring cost of Obamacare, even though the BLS says there is no healthcare inflation. There are a few areas that jump out at me and paint an even darker picture. Three of the strongest retail sales categories over the last year were auto sales, furniture sales, and building materials, with growth of 6.2%, 5.2%, and 4.3% respectively. The main reason these three areas have been relatively strong is that you don't need cash, a minimal level of income, or even a job to make a purchase at these retailers. All you need is for the finance company employed by the retailer to approve you for a loan. The 7-year 0% auto loans go to those with decent credit. The subprime loans go to anyone that can fog a mirror. Every furniture retailer is offering 5 years with no interest payments for their Veterans Day sales. Lowe's and Home Depot offer no interest for 12 or 24 months for any purchase over $500. It's the Fed's easy money 0% interest scheme that is producing this fake strength. The people buying those cars, sofas, and washing machines don't have the money, and when the bill comes due, the losses will be epic. The powers that should be really starting to worry after seeing the auto sales crash, despite huge incentives being offered by the desperate car dealers along with the easy credit. It seems they may have saturated the market by giving away brand new cars to anyone with a pulse. At least the repo companies will be booming over the next few years and used car prices should crash. Another strong area has been restaurants and bars, with 5.5% year-over-year growth in October. This is significantly lower than the growth earlier in the year, but it is still decent. I believe this is the area that will be the last to crash. Older people are drowning their sorrows at bars. Young people living with their parents can't afford houses, rent, or vehicles, but socializing with their friends using a credit card is still possible. Life has become so miserable for so many people, the only enjoyment they can find is going out to a restaurant or a bar. The last strong area is internet retail, with a 7.1% growth over last year. Despite state governments doing their best to crush internet retailers by adding sales tax to most transactions, consumers are staying away from malls in droves. Who would possibly want to drive miles to a crowded, decaying mall, venture into a Sears, Kmart, or JCPenney, and deal with the low IQ drone employees, find out what you wanted is out of stock, or pay more than you would online? Amazon and the rest of the online retail establishment will continue to destroy bricks and mortar retailers. Besides gas stations, only department stores and electronics stores have negative year-to-date sales after 10 months. The downward death spiral of Sears, Penny, Macy's, Best Buy, and many lesser retailers will not reverse. Their real estate is old, decrepit, and antiquated. After this Christmas season, there will be announcements of hundreds of store closings as ghost malls spook your suburban sprawl landscape. Lastly, one chart that you can see, even the most brainless twit on CNBC, that we are presently in a recession, despite the rhetoric and propaganda being spewed by the dying legacy media. Look closely at where retail sales peaked and began to fall. Quantitative easing stopped on October the 29th, 2014. Shockingly, retail sales began falling and haven't stopped. The trillions of fiat printed since 2008 has solved nothing. Dr. Bernanke and Dr. Yellen injected a massive dose of adrenaline into a patient with cancer. The patient showed the appearance of recovery, but the cancer has metastasized and spread throughout the entire system. Competent doctors would have cut the cancer out by allowing bankrupt banks to liquidate and purging the system of cancerous debt. Instead, they took steps to promote the proliferation and spread of the cancerous debt. Now the patient is terminal. If it looks like a recession, walks like a recession, and quacks like a recession, ladies and gentlemen, it's a recession. Well, Russia is apparently creating weapons unlike anything the world has ever seen. Plans for a giant self-propelled nuclear torpedo that can create a giant tsunami more than 1,000 feet tall were recently leaked by mistake by the Russian media. Apparently, the warheads on these torpedoes are designed to create so much radiation, quote-unquote, that everything living will be killed, including those that try to survive the attack by hiding in underground shelters. These robotic mini-submarines would have a range of up to 10,000 kilometers and would be able to evade all existing US detection systems. To say that such a weapon would be a game changer would be a massive understatement. These weapons were displayed on Russian state television for a few moments during a recent broadcast. According to Russian officials, this was an accident. A close-up of a confidential document detailing Ocean Multipurpose System Status 6 was broadcast for several seconds by Channel 1 Russia and NTV during coverage of a meeting between Vladimir Putin and military officials. I have no more information about this, but it just reinforces my argument that you'd better get moving if you want to be out of the United States in time. Well, a gallon of gas now costs less than it did 10 years ago. That's the result of a near doubling of US oil production since 2008. The reason we're grateful today is that we were miserable yesterday, which incentivized oil companies to get innovative and find a solution. The more you look, the more you'll see this pattern. Everything good today was born from something that wasn't good in the past. The reverse is also true. Most of our current problems stem from past comforts that we cheered for, but which made us lazy and complacent. Recognizing how powerful this irony is might change your opinions about financial stress. In the early 2000s, large egos collided with low IQs to produce some of the worst financial behavior in history. Anyone could have anything they wanted, thanks to an endless river of no questions asked debt. People loved it. The feeling of success was effortless while it lasted, which of course it didn't. What's rarely discussed, but is just as important, is how the pain of the ensuing financial crisis changed consumer behavior for the better. A deep recession scares people witless, which forces them towards smarter decisions. It took 10% unemployment and a 50% market crash to get people to cut up credit cards, move out of the house they couldn't afford, sell the stuff they never used, and start saving money again. Unfortunately, the trends have all turned back down again, but the principle applied for several years. It's hard to admit that people act smarter when they're stressed and the economy is weak, because no one wants a weak economy. But there's so much indication that it's true. Necessity is the mother of invention, and there's evidence that entrepreneurship increases during recessions. According to the Kauffman Foundation, More than half of Fortune 500 companies were founded during recessions or a bear market. The supermarket and laundromat were both created during the Great Depression as solutions to a weak economy. Penicillin was created and credited with saving tens of millions of lives, but it didn't go into widespread use until World War II stimulated frantic scientific development. Quoting Nassim Taleb, "The excess energy released from overreaction to setbacks is what innovates." Unquote. In their book, Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much, Sendil Mulainathan and Eldar Shafir write, "When scarcity captures the mind, we become more attentive and efficient. There are many situations in our lives where maintaining focus can be challenging. We procrastinate at work because we keep getting distracted. We buy overpriced items at the grocery store because our minds are elsewhere. A tight deadline or a shortage of cash focuses us on the task at hand. With our minds riveted, we are less prone to careless error. This makes perfect sense. Scarcity captures us because it's important, worthy of our attention." End of quote. Taleb writes about the same idea in his book, Antifragile, and I quote, "The record shows that for society, the richer we become, the harder it gets to live within our means. Abundance is harder for us to handle than scarcity." End of quote. The downside of not having enough stress can be amazing. When online gaming company Zynga went public a few years ago, it warned investors of a weird problem. Quote, "Many of our employees may be able to receive significant proceeds from sales of our equity in the public markets after our initial public offering, which may reduce their motivation to continue to work for us." End of quote. Employees were so successful, they lost motivation. Innovation doesn't happen with deep pockets. It happens at companies that will die unless they do something big, fast. Apple was nearly bankrupt and created the iPod. Microsoft had $60 billion in the bank and created the Zoom. Recently, I heard about someone working at a company that had paid off its debt, freeing it from the chains of creditors. You would have thought this was a good thing. He disagreed. Quote, "All companies should have a little debt. Just enough to keep them focused, less distracted by temptation, and to think twice before blowing money on bad ideas." End of quote. Too much freedom can be devastating, as lottery winners and trust fund babies often prove. There's some convincing data behind this idea. Kelly McGonigal is a health psychologist who, as she says, quote unquote, was taught to view stress as the enemy of well-being, productivity, happiness, and of health. But she changed her mind after looking at the data, and she describes an amazing theory called the stress paradox. Years ago, the World Gallup poll asked people from 122 countries if they experienced a lot of stress the last 24 hours. This created a stress index, ranking countries around the world. Psychologists then overlaid the stress index against things like GDP growth, life expectancy, happiness, life satisfaction, and fulfillment at work. They expected a strong correlation between stress and happiness, and there was. but it was in the opposite direction they expected. Countries with higher than average stress were happier, healthier, and more satisfied with life than less stressed ones. This is probably because stress pushes people into action towards things they enjoy and that matter most. Quoting McGonigal, "Stress can be a signal that you are engaged, pursuing goals, and facing challenges that will also give rise to meaning in your life. Even though we experience stress in the moment as undesirable, it's a barometer for how the things we most desire." It is a function of showing how engaged you are with the things that ultimately bring learning, growth, and happiness. End of quote. Like a stressful economy brings us low oil prices, less consumer debt, and a higher savings debt. This has obvious limits, as Taleb says. Try to get into trouble. I mean serious, but not terminal trouble. End of quote. Too much stress clearly backfires. The working poor are often criticized as lazy and unmotivated, like they don't have enough stress. But as Ezra Klein wrote a few years ago, these critics, quote, "don't seem to realize how difficult it is to focus on college when you're also working full time, how much planning it takes to reliably commute to work without a car, or the agonizing choices faced by families in which both parents work and a child falls ill." End of quote. A little stress sharpens your focus. Too much destroys it. But most of us can learn from the stress paradox. How many people were excited about $4 gas, realizing it was the key to an energy revolution that would usher in cheap gas? Very few. How many of us got excited during the financial crisis, realizing it was step one towards better household financial behavior? Almost no one. Perhaps we shouldn't cheer for financial stress, but just realize how necessary it is to make progress.
Share the truth. Invite others to listen to Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. Richard Martin produces his shows single-handedly, based on his extensive reading and research. Every week, Richard gives you the facts with no spin, for you to make informed decisions on world events that will affect your life. Now, let's get back to today's show.
All right, let's take a few emails, starting with an email from Alberto. "Hi, Richard. Listening to you on Podbean on recording. You fixed the problem with the low audio. Thanks for that. Why did you never come back to Gary Null's channel once he had been web-attacked and then reorganized? No one ever mentioned why you didn't come back to PRN." Well, I'll answer that first of all before I continue. As so often with these things, lies and rumors abound, Alberto. My departure from PRN had absolutely nothing to do with the web attack on Gary's channel. Absolutely nothing whatsoever. As I did explain before, I will explain quickly again. Back earlier this year, in January or February, I think it was, there was a pipe break in the studio on the Upper West Side, in which flooding took place and the fire department closed down the operation at that location. And we were informed that the organization would have to move to different premises. But one of the emails that we received stated quite clearly that there was a probability that PRN would no longer be able to offer live shows. The word might have been possibility as opposed to probability. I don't remember. But the sentence was quite clear. And I called up at that point to get information, and I was given very short shrift, because they never really liked me very much at PRA. And some people did, but others, in a word, didn't. I won't go into details. It had to do, I think, with the content of my shows. But anyway, be that as it may, I didn't get any coherent answers. And so, in desperation, I started looking around to see where I might be able to record live. And unfortunately, I didn't find anywhere. And at that moment, by sheer serendipity, Donald Warren, our current engineer, popped up out of the ethers and offered to take over my show. And I couldn't have been happier. It couldn't have come at a better time. And I accepted with pleasure. And I chose Podbean, which is the same company that does Gary's shows, as my venue. And so I put in a change, and we continued, as you know now, with Podbean. And that sent them into paroxysms of rage at PRN. They deleted all my previous shows going back over about 10 years. They just got rid of them, although they were asked to keep them, and Podbean gave us specific instructions as to how they should maintain them. They ignored it and just deleted the shows, just like that. All my shows going back, as I say, to about 2005. Too bad, so sad, as they say, but I think that answers your question, Alberto. Moving on with Alberto's email. A question. I am selling a pre-Columbian art piece I inherited from my late grandfather. Would you recommend someone to handle this for me in Manhattan, a gallery or specialty shop of confidence, or auction? You have guided me before about jewelry, so I thought to ask. Or post to eBay. Keep up the good work. I hope I have your latest emails right. Kind regards, Alberto, New York City. Alberto, I have some experience with gold and precious metals, but I don't have any experience with jewelry and antiques. Not so much jewelry, but art. I would say my experience from talking to other people is pay up for the exposure. In other words, even if it seems like you'll make a lot less money by going with the high-end auctioneers, you are really better off because you will get a better class of person attending and you will get more people. So it is worth your while to spend more and take it to someone in Manhattan. And as I say, the best deal of all, I think in your case, without knowing details of what you actually have, would be an auction. So I hope that answers your questions, and so let's move on now to Gilbert Pisinich, who says, "Hi, Richard. I found that poll stating that 89% of Republicans seldom trust the federal government interesting. The questions that come to mind for me are, how much would the statistic change if the president was a white Democrat? How would it change if he was an African-American Republican? And how would it change if he were a white Republican? The US populace is still quite racist, pretty much like a good part of humanity. Can anyone imagine an African-American prime minister in the UK? Best, Gilbert." Frankly, these days, Gilbert, I don't think it would change in the slightest. The distrust, the mistrust that goes over the entire political spectrum is universal, in my opinion, with the possible exception of the 0.1%. But that's going to change in a jiffy once the real downturn comes and the depression sets in earnest. So I don't think that in this particular case that it makes any difference. Other questions you might ask, yes, they might definitely compartmentalize themselves into different categories. But in the case of trust in government, I think it's universal. Okay, so now we have an email from John Nevin, who says, RM, I want, for now, to get out of HSBC for checking and savings. Credit unions don't seem to be accessible. Gary says non-commercial banks will be less likely to seize assets. So I am thinking a small non-commercial bank like Carver or Astoria. Your thoughts? Thank you, John Nevin. Well, John, until a short while back, I was indeed talking about credit unions and smaller banks. These days, I think you're better off sending your money abroad to a bank account in a completely different jurisdiction, preferably not European, which gives rise to Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan perhaps, anywhere away from the Western influence. And keep the rest of your money, frankly, in a big bank, like a Bank America, simply to have access to frequent ATMs for when you need your cash out. In other words, keep the money that you will need over a 3 to 4 month period and send the rest of the money out of the country. That's my advice to you at this point, John. I've been coming close to this. It hasn't been my recommendation up until now, but if you have large sums, then you can indeed open an account at Treasury Direct and buy Treasury bills, which is what I've suggested that everybody do. But if you have smaller sums that you will need from time to time, and you would like to protect against the ravages of the American system, then I think you need to send them abroad. Well, consumer confidence unexpectedly declined in November to the lowest level in more than a year, as Americans grew less enthusiastic about the labour market outlook. The Conference Board's index slumped to 90.4, the lowest since September 2014, from a revised October reading of 99.1, according to the New York-based private research group. The November gauge was weaker than the lowest forecast in a Bloomberg survey of economists. The cutoff date of the Conference Board's survey was November the 12th. The share of Americans who see greater job availability in the next 6 months declined to the lowest level since October 2011, and more expect their incomes to decline. While consumers were less upbeat about the labour market, the report showed buying plans held up and suggested steady spending as the holiday shopping season begins. Lynn Franco, Director of Economic Indicators at the Conference Board, said, quote unquote, "Heading into 2016, consumers are cautious about the labour market and expect little change in business conditions." The median forecast called for the gauge to rise to 99.5 in November, according to the Bloomberg survey of 70 economists. Estimates ranged from 96 to 103.5. In January, the index reached an almost 8-year high of 103.8. The drop was broad-based, with confidence declining among all age groups, particularly among those younger than 35 and most income brackets. Sentiment slumped for Americans earning less than $15,000 a year. The Conference Board's measure of consumer expectations for the next 6 months dropped 78.6 from 88.7 in October. Some 11.6% anticipated more jobs will be available, down from 14.4% a month earlier. 11.8% of respondents projected their incomes will decrease in the next 6 months, the highest since September 2014. Well, I've mentioned the demise of the American mall quite often over the years, but it does seem to be accelerating as time goes by. The popularity of large shopping malls is now in an unmistakable decline, and, in fact, could be said to be racing towards demise. In 2015, this fact has become increasingly apparent to many consumers, retailers, mall operators, and investors. So let's have a look at what's killing the American malls. I really think it's the result of several economic and societal issues. Here are some of the causal factors which support my view. Going to the mall as a destination or hangout is simply no longer necessary. Years ago, young people used to go to a mall to see and be seen. That is no longer the case. With smartphones like Apple's iPhone, you can text message a group or an individual and video chat. If you want to watch a movie, you can download it from any one of the many streaming services such as Netflix, Apple's iTunes, or Ultraviolet. Want some pizza or other food? Then just go to an app and order it for delivery. As for records, well, now we have digital downloads. Traditional malls were built in such a configuration that at each end of the mall, a big box anchor store was placed. These were stores owned and operated by Macy's, Lord & Taylor, Bloomingdale's, Nordstrom's, Sears and JCPenney, to name a few. Sears and JCPenney are both companies which are struggling to survive. The concept was to drive traffic into the mall via the big box retailers. That's no longer happening as it was in the past. In fact, if you travel to malls across the United States, you will notice more vacant stores within malls that do not have a coming soon sign. Think about Apple. Stores in malls which have an Apple retail store tend to have higher sales than stores in malls without an Apple retail store. The American consumers are more astute and savvy than they've been given credit for. Using the internet, they are able to perform price discovery and get the best prices for nearly any type of product. Shipping for many retailers is free. Amazon even has a premium service, Amazon Prime, which guarantees two-day delivery and subscription to its streaming video service. Furthermore, the brick-and-mortar chains have built up their direct-to-consumer web-based sales and logistics networks. So, even with gas prices as low as they are, the need to drive to a store, deal with parking hassles, and waste valuable time is lessened with modern shopping technology. Well, you know, I really sometimes catch myself wondering why Americans allow big business and the banks to dominate their lives. Why, for example, do Americans have to pay more for pharmaceuticals than do the citizens of any other developed nation? Well, that's partly because it's perfectly legal in the US, but not in most other nations, for the makers of branded drugs to pay the makers of generic drugs to delay introduce cheaper unbranded equivalents after patents on the brands have expired. This costs you an estimated $3.5 billion a year. This is nothing more than a hidden upward redistribution of your incomes to Pfizer, Merck, and other big proprietary drug companies, their executives, and major shareholders. Ladies and gentlemen, that's all it is. Nothing more, nothing less. You also pay more for internet service than the inhabitants of any other developed nation. The average cable bill in the United States rose 5% in 2012, which is the latest year available, nearly triple the rate of inflation. Why? Because 80% of you have no choice of internet service provider, which allows them to charge you as much as they like. Internet service in your benighted country costs 3.5 times more than it does in France, for example, where the typical consumer can choose between 7 providers, from you to Comcast, Verizon, or any other giant company, its executives and major shareholders. Likewise, the interest you pay on home mortgages or college loans is higher than it would be if the big banks that now dominate the financial industry had to work harder to get your business. As recently as 2000, America's 5 largest banks held 25% of all US banking assets. Now they hold 44%, which gives them a lock on many such loans. Well, on August the 12th, 1961, Walter Ulbricht, the chairman of the State Council in East Germany, signed an order to close the border and begin building a wall around East Berlin. It happened quickly. Soldiers began tearing up roads leading into West Berlin almost immediately and actually stood with weapons at the border with orders to shoot anyone who tried to cross. Before long, there were barbed wire fences, then concrete walls, then dogs, guard towers, and even anti-tank obstacles. Of course, the East German government told people that the wall was for their protection, ostensibly to keep out rapists and thieves. They said that there were too many foreigners coming into East Berlin who unfairly bought up state-subsidized goods. They also warned people of the looming threat of fascist invaders and even went as far as to call the wall an anti-fascist protective rampart. I remember how the Berlin Wall was a symbol of tyranny and oppression. From the steps of the Brandenburg Gate in West Berlin, Ronald Reagan told the world in a now famous speech from 1987, quote, "The advance of human liberty can only strengthen the cause of world peace. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." End of quote. Back then, if you'd talked about building a wall in America, they'd have called you a commie. But now, in the land of the free, it's all the rage to build a new wall. They're also talking about rounding up Muslims and having databases just in case you have the audacity to be brown. There's already a massive level of surveillance in the land of the free. Everything you do online is monitored and tracked. The police state grows by the day. Federally funded police forces now don combat boots, Kevlar vests, and intimidating paramilitary attire to drive around in their urban assault vehicles, as if they were in downtown Mogadishu. Nearly every federal agency, down to the Fish and Wildlife Service, has its own gun-toting police force, which makes it pretty unsurprising that civil asset forfeiture has risen an average of 21% per year for the past 2 decades. Yet, despite all of this security and surveillance, the government still doesn't feel that it's enough. The US Department released an alert last week telling American citizens to avoid travel and public places for the next 3 months. Apparently, we should all be cowering in fear in our homes, grateful that the NSA is reading our emails. The Department of Homeland Security is bringing back, "If you see something, say something," in the hopes of having the citizens all rat each other out. Former CIA Director Jack DeVeeden stated, "I have never felt more uncomfortable than I do today," and that today is the most dangerous time ever. Someone needs to give this man a history lesson. Human civilization has had to deal with deranged threats for thousands of years. Yes, there are some nut jobs out there, crazed lone wolf gunmen, angry teenagers and even terrorists with an agenda, all of whom intend to do harm to innocents. But having travelled to nearly 120 countries on all seven continents, I can tell you from personal experience that the world is actually a pretty safe place. Today, I can hop on a plane and be on the other side of the planet tomorrow morning, even in a country where I don't know a soul. You couldn't do that 500 years ago. You couldn't even do it 100 years ago. Centuries ago, even on the other side of the planet, changed full risk held peril. So the time when the Anthony is actually one of the safest in the history of the world. The far greater danger out there, more than angry teenagers with men in the cage, is the palpable distinct decline of freedom. I don't know where the land of the free went, or where the leader of the free world ran off to. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, I've realized that I'm probably going to have to concentrate my research a lot more on ISIS and the problem of ISIS in future. And this is a really great irritation for me, because I am actually not the least interested in war or what the grotesque human race does in the spirit of killing itself off. But it seems, as it did over 9/11, that there are unspoken elements that need to be addressed, and which, as usual, will not be touched by the mainstream media, but which, unfortunately, are going to be gravely affecting our lives for the foreseeable and unforeseeable future. So reluctantly, I must dip my toe in here. I thought I had done my bit a couple of weeks ago with my lengthy report on the origins of ISIS, which, by the way, you should read to start with, because it really gives you the lowdown on what it represents for America. So I will start with this. If Westerners are wondering why, despite attacks on Western soil and alleged military campaigns predicated on these provocations setting out to eradicate ISIS, the terrorist organization not only still thrives but is thriving, the answer is the West has no intention of eradicating it. Fighting ISIS at its source for the West means putting the blade to its own throat. It is clearly responsible for the rise and perpetuation of this terrorist group, not through the mere consequences of its actions, but through an intentional, concerted effort to create a formidable proxy army to wage its wars in the Middle East and North Africa with. ISIS is not only destined to divide and destroy Syria and Iraq. If the West has its way, the terrorist organization is destined to move into Iran, the Caucasus region of southern Russia, and Central Asia next. It is a proxy army built atop of what the United States and Saudi Arabia accomplished with Al-Qaeda starting in the 1980s, which itself was merely a continuation of the British Empire's use of Wahhabi fanatics to overthrow its Ottoman rivals over a century ago. When the West calls this a long war, believe me, they mean it. And it will longer still be until the people of the West realize their governments aren't waging a war on terror. They are waging a war of terror. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, here we are yet again at the end of another show, and I am hoping that you will have a very successful week ahead, having dealt with the delights of Thanksgiving and now building up to the delights of Christmas. So, with that said, I wish you all the best. I will be back with you, as always, on Friday. This is Richard Martin saying bye-bye till then.
And there you have it. You decide.